So I have to tell you, I like the British people. And I'll give you a couple of reasons why. Number one, you had one of those DNA tests done recently and found out I'm 60% English, which was not a big surprise because my mother's family name is Cottingham, or it's Cottingham, right? It's supposed to be Cottingham. And then the other 35%, or 35% is also Scott, which might explain a lot of internal struggles I have. And my son lives in England. And I have three little U.S.-British grandsons there, so I just got back from visiting them not too long ago. So very pleased about that. I want to introduce to you our BBC folks here. Tim Franks anchors the BBC World Service's leading international current affairs program, NewsHour, which you guys hear on Michigan Radio. He's worked with, the BBC's Middle East correspondent, Europe correspondent, worked in Washington, D.C., right after 9/11, too. That must have been an interesting time for a reporter. Earlier in his career, he was a political correspondent based in the Houses of Parliament, so we can talk about politics, too, right? As much as possible, Tim likes to take this program on the road, which is why he's in Michigan right now. You might have heard some of his reporting this morning. We're going to talk about that a little more in a moment. Joe Flodo is a BBC correspondent and editor in charge of NewsHour, World Update, Weekend, and Witness on the BBC World Service. The World Tonight on domestic BBC Radio 4 channel, which I don't think we can get that anywhere in the United States, can we? Yeah. He was the BBC's Asia Bureau Chief. Before that, worked in the Middle East for a decade, and he's reported for more than 60 countries for the BBC. So they're rank amateurs, obviously, right? So you guys have been to town, in the metro area as well. What have you been working on?
Hello, everybody. And thank you very much for coming out. It's extremely good of you. And it's wonderful to be here. And I hope I'm not going to howl round. We've been working on two stories. We only flew in a couple of days ago, so we didn't have very long to put much together, but one of the stories was looking ahead to who the Democrats could, should, might choose to put up against Donald Trump, which way the center of gravity in the party is swinging at the moment, and given that Michigan played a small role, so I understand, in 2016, it seemed like a good place to come. And the other thing was, I'm afraid, just a bit of gorgeousness, which was, it's the refuge of the journalistic scoundrel to go for anniversaries. So who could resist the 60th anniversary of Motown? We did the broadcast earlier today from the Motown Museum and spoke to the founder's niece, who runs Motown Museum, but the highlight was speaking to one of the founding members of the Four Tops in Studio A. So that was just a little bit of loveliness, which we're allowed to do, as well as the serious stuff about Washington politics.
What have you been doing? Tagging around with him, doing fun stuff, and letting him do the politics?
I mean, looking for lost luggage, but... More importantly, I've been looking forward to events like this. We broadcast around the world. We've got millions of listeners, and they do get in touch on Twitter and on email. But it is great and a huge privilege to actually see real listeners in front of you. You are real. You exist. You're not virtual. And that's great. And, you know, feel free to throw abuse at us and suggestions on how we can improve our programming. But thank you very much for listening. We depend on you, and it's great to know you're real.
So the theme of this presentation tonight is basically to get an international perspective on U.S. politics, which I'm looking forward to a lot. I want to tell you, though, I was in England over the holidays. My son lives near the town of Leicester, and he got together with the BBC Leicester radio station. They thought it would be really funny to put Leicester on BBC Leicester. We've got like a 10-minute interview. He's basically asking me how I like the country. And then he turns in the last couple of minutes and says, "So about American politics." I thought, 2 minutes First of all, I don't think I'm qualified to be briefing anybody on American politics right now because I don't think, well, not too many people actually know what's going on. And secondly, 2 minutes, really? So this is my chance for revenge. Let's start about that. You guys get around more than most of us. How does the world see American politics today?
He looks at me. How does the world look at American politics? Oh, I tell you, actually, how does the world look at British politics?
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's a different question. Look, I'm going to say a whole bunch of things that you already know. The world is intensely interested in what is going on here. Because you matter. I mean, the US is still the most powerful country in the world. It is also founded on an idea which has enormous importance and significance and purchase through a lot of the world as well. So, you know, what happens here, what's going on here, in a way, in a very fundamental level, in terms of the nature of politics and democracy and how the different bits of the political system work, you know, without wanting to sound too holy and sanctimonious about it, a lot of the parts of the world that we broadcast to and where I am lucky enough to travel to still, you know, this idea of a democracy in which the press can say more or less whatever they like and politicians can say more or less whatever they like, and there are supposedly, I mean, you can tell me how well you think the checks and balances are working, but there are checks and balances. That is something that is extraordinary and not to be sneered at. So when there are moments when there's conflict, when there's confrontation, how those bits work when there's friction, that matters enormously. But obviously also the remarkable events of the last couple of years, or more than the last couple of years, when Donald Trump sort of... I was thinking recently how one can talk about the Trump phenomenon without just resorting to the sort of the abstract ideas of somebody ripping up conventional wisdom or the status quo. And I was thinking, actually, just as I was coming here, that I was thinking of those images. We don't get them before football games, soccer games, as you call them, in Britain, but you know those moments before college football games when the teams sort of run through the paper banner and it sort of explodes into a million pieces. Well, it feels a bit like that's what Donald Trump did a couple of years ago through that sort of paper banner that said this is how we do politics. He just smashed his way through that, and we're still trying to work out what it all means. So. In terms of that, that's, I think, how the rest of the world... Gosh, what an airy generalization. How the rest of the world views American politics. But it is that sense of, gosh, all the things that we thought we knew are now up in the air, and we're having to question what it means in terms of international diplomacy, international trade agreements, the sort of language that's used that is part of the normal discourse. All that is now, it seems, up for grabs. So I think, probably quite similar to how you see things, we were agog at the fact that Donald Trump became the Republican nominee and then became the president, and we are still agog and utterly fascinated.
Pick it up there, Joe.
One thing I would add...
is that it's not a universal global view of America or its presence. So if you look at the detailed research that's been done in the last year or so, Donald Trump has an approval rating of about 80% in the Philippines. In South Africa, he's really quite popular. In Nigeria, again, more than 50, 60% of people think he's a good thing. In Russia, interestingly, that peaked in about 2017 and then came back down again and is now very negative. But, I mean, one of the things that Tim has highlighted is just how this has changed the rules. And a lot of the assumptions that we made about politics, not just in America, but everywhere else, have been shaken over the last few years. And that is a good thing as a journalist. Intellectually, it's something we should have done earlier. And America is one of those places that is forcing us to re-examine the relationship between electorates and those elected to represent them. That also brings in questions about trust in journalists like us, institutions like the BBC. I'm not going to speak for other organisations, but there is a sense there that people don't trust the voice of the media as much as they once did, that we have to earn that trust back, that politicians certainly don't seem to have that trust from the electorate. And, you know, there's a fascinating amount of research being done over what's gone wrong in the last 30 years to get us to where we are. As journalists, we're looking at that reality and how that's playing out in real time. And you can feel that acute sense of rupture with assumptions. And that is a fascinating place to be.
Let's talk about a couple of issues. One of the things that Donald Trump has said is he's going to build the wall along the Mexican-U.S. border. Immigration is an issue all over the world, especially European countries have been experiencing an influx of refugees. Kind of compare and contrast what's happening in Europe and what's happening here. Tim?
Well, I suppose the parallels are, by the way, we're going to have to stop looking at each other in a panic-stricken fashion. I guess the parallels
are... You can't see that when they're in the studio on the radio, right?
We're not on the radio.
I guess the parallels are that there is a surge in populism and nationalism around the world. There is... certainly, I mean, in Britain, one of the things undoubtedly that fueled the Brexit vote was a feeling that immigration had run out of control, and that part of the reason it had run out of control was because Britain was not able, under the rules of the European Union, which is much more than a, as I'm sure you know, much more than a free trade area. It's a whole system that means that you get the free movement of people as well as goods and capital. So that somehow, it was felt, had run amok, and it was meaning that native British people were losing out. And so this whole sort of idea of taking back control, of taking back sovereignty, was immensely powerful. And I'm sure it's a similar thing here as well. That any time you've got, I mean, Joe said the word rupture, you've got that sense of turbulence, and you've got that sense of, you know, I'm not in control of my future, and maybe this is one of the ways in which I can get back control, then that is immensely powerful. So I think, you know, we've seen it in Italy, we've seen it to a certain extent in Germany, and the way that is fueling the politics there, and many, many other countries. It is a very powerful thing.
Yeah, these populist political movements, most of the time, result in a more conservative government, and I'm wondering, what's the tie between that? Because, you know, we could have gone with Bernie Sanders, who's also a populist, but we went with Donald Trump. But in many cases, they have been going for the more conservative candidate. Why?
I'm going to disagree slightly with that. I'm not sure they're going for conservatives in the traditional sense. So we've got, across Europe anyway, you've got, I think, a combination of what you could probably describe as left of centre social and economic fiscal policy. So people are looking for more state intervention to fill the gaps where the market certainly hasn't worked, where the financial crisis left people behind, but much more socially conservative on lots of issues, including immigration, including probably things like homosexual rights. And so that is a unique mixture. Well, not unique. It's a new combination that people are exploiting. So what you get you're getting in Europe with the populist movements is this demand for a correction in where people think they've been left behind politically, and a desire to return to a sometimes imagined, but a very strongly held belief to return to a much more certain and secure social and cultural past.
Let's talk about journalism just a little bit. The New Yorker carried a story this week revealing that there's this very close relationship between the Trump White House and Fox News. Most of us knew that. We didn't know the level of detail, right? We've also, in America, journalists have been called the enemy of the people. As journalists outside of America, what do you think of those things?
Well, I mean, obviously, everybody who works for the BBC went to one Oxford college. So that's, I mean, in that sense, it's sort of nothing that we think is particularly unhealthy. Actually, that was such a weak gag. I've forgotten your question. What do we think about
the state of journalism in this country? State of journalism. And the relationship between the White House and Fox News.
Okay. I'll leave the relationship between the White House and Fox News to Joe, because he's got lots of very trenchant things to say about that.
he's thinking
But
now.
The state of journalism in this country, I read the New York Times, I read the Washington Post every day as part of my job.
The fake news.
The fake news. you know, I think journalism is... It feels to me as if it's pretty healthy. I realise, obviously, that journalism here, as journalism everywhere, is going through all sorts of stresses and strains because of new media. I mean, it could also be to do with the politics, but it's to do with social media and the prevalence of other streams of information. And, you know, revenue is incredibly difficult, and there are all sorts of financial pressures. But I sort of think that journalism feels as if it's in relatively rude health here. I'm also slightly sensitive because I think journalists complaining about how tough it is to do their jobs, well, you know, it's a lot tougher in a lot of other places in the world. I'm not suggesting that you were saying this, but I think sometimes, you know, people are looking to us to try and mediate, that's why they call us the media, what is an incredibly contingent and difficult and turbulent place. So actually for us, it's a great time, as Joe was saying. I mean, all these sort of new questions about nostrums and the received wisdom, the fact that that is all up in the air, it's great for us.
Let me, before you start, just one point about other journalists having it much worse. I was training journalists in Africa, the southern part of Africa at one point, and went to this small mountain kingdom called Swaziland, and one of my journalists was missing. And I said, where is he? Is he coming? No, he's in jail. Why? Because he criticized the king taking his 12th wife, and because they didn't do a background check on her, and the prime minister threw him in jail. Is he going to be getting a trial? We don't know. That's the state of journalism in other countries. Joe.
Yeah. I mean, I would definitely agree with that. And I used to work in China, where being a Chinese journalist is pretty tough. And I used to run the bureau in Baghdad, where it's even tougher. But I do think journalism has a problem at the moment. That the world is America and Europe have very divided societies. And that division is exacerbated by new media, and people are flocking towards the warm embrace of like-minded views. And you know, one of the things that we at the BBC struggle with is just trying to hold our line, because we're telling stories. We're not trying to make you feel good about what you think. But if you look at Trump, Mr. Donald Trump, the president and Fox News, during his election campaign, I think there were two newspapers in this whole country who came out in his favour. So when he turns around and says, the media is against me, does he have a point? does he have a point? And more broadly, and a bigger problem for us, is are we in the media speaking for those people who no longer trust us and who no longer trust the world to do good by them and to represent their views? And that is a serious challenge, because we have a ruptured society in lots of parts of the world, and the media has its role to play in there, but I think we're struggling. I'm not such an optimist.
I'm going to crudely link a couple of things going on right now. Britain's at a very interesting moment in its exit from the European Union. You're running up against a deadline, and that's about trade and being able to deal with the goods the way you want to. We've got the same thing going here in a different way with tariffs and reworking trade deals. So how do you think those two things affect the idea of free and open markets?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that Brexit and the reason the Brexit vote went to leave the European Union was necessarily to do with trade. I think it was much more to do with identity and that sort of sense of what are we as a country and what is our place in the world. And obviously that's something that the United Kingdom has been struggling with for many, many decades. And it was also to do with, I think, what Joe was saying, and this sort of broad feeling of disaffection, of alienation, of people being able to give, in the British vernacular, fat two fingers. I don't know what one would say here, but...
Just the one finger.
I think it'd probably just be the one finger. I knew what it was, Joe. I just didn't want to be indelicate. This is being recorded. So a fat two fingers to the establishment. And, you know... It's funny. I was anchoring the post referendum program on BBC World Service that came on at 10 p.m. when polls closed on referendum day, and I had a panel with me, and as I was introducing them, I said, "So we've just had this vote on whether to leave the European Union," and then it suddenly occurred to me, what does that vote actually mean? And I asked the panel, what do you think you were voting for? And these were people who voted for and against. And they came out with completely different answers, because for them, membership of the European Union meant very, very different things. So, I mean, you could argue that perhaps it's a similar thing that's fueling Donald Trump's feelings about the deficit or about the rest of the world making a mockery of the United States. But I think for Britain and its place in Europe, it's a much deeper thing.
Top that.
Okay. So I think looking at Donald Trump's economic view of the world and of America, there's an awful lot of economic nostalgia. So you look at the primacy given to old-style manufacturing and coal mining. So there are many, many more jobs. There's probably 100,000 more jobs in solar panels in this country than there are in coal mining. But coal mining speaks to people's sense of a real economy, real jobs, jobs that people understand. Similarly, in the UK, we are obsessed by fishing. And fishing in the UK has it's a tiny place in the economy. You've heard of Harrods, big department store in London. So the turnover of Harrods is more than the turnover of the entire fishing industry in the UK. But fishing is an emotional industry. It speaks to people's... We're an island nation. It speaks to people's sense of what's right in the world. And I think that there's quite a lot of that in today's politics. Part of Donald Trump's lack of political correctness is also, I think, appealing to people's sense that everything's moved very fast. The financial crisis, the change in global economy, globalization, transformation of jobs.
Social changes.
Yeah. Social change, all of that kind of stuff. And that's where the economic policy comes in.
I want to ask you guys this question, because I got to think, I was talking to Steve Krupinski earlier about questions we ought to ask you. And Joe, you're going to start this time, so you don't have to follow him up. You guys have covered bureaus around the world. Have you ever seen a situation where the government just shuts down for 35 days?
Oh, I can answer this one. No.
I mean, what do you... I mean, it's such a dysfunctional thing. And who do you blame? I mean, really, because...
Belgium shut down for more than a year.
Well, they didn't have a government, but I mean, but they still had federal workers.
You're right. No, that's a unique take on how to run things.
All right. Here's, I think, a pretty interesting question that was brought up. What kind of stories do you guys do about the U.S. that really gets the attention of your audience around the world?
Ones involving Donald Trump? Actually, I mean, on that point, and it's a very trivial way in which, or a trivial indication of how things have changed, was his use of Twitter. I mean, there was a tweet today which was, I think it was his first tweet of the morning, which was essentially saying it was not a campaign contribution, and in any case, I can't remember exactly what the wording was, but essentially he was making reference to the fact that there is a story out there that allegedly money was paid on behalf of the president, before he was president, to a porn star with whom he had allegedly had an affair shortly after his wife had given birth to his youngest child, and that this was happening in the run-up to a presidential election and might possibly be an illegal campaign contribution. Now, you know, if that had been Angela Merkel tweeting that, we probably would have covered it. But the fact that Donald Trump had tweeted it this morning, you know, it didn't make a... There was no ripple. I mean, obviously, the story might end up as something that we will be covering, and it's not that we are not covering it out of prurience or tedium or whatever, but it's just the rules are changing. So in terms of the sort of the bar of interest, or not interest, but just sort of what counts as the news of the day, it's super easy for us. And I think maybe we slightly fell into the trap of doing it of the sort of, oh my goodness, look at what he has tweeted today, and that would be the sort of the spur then to do a take on whatever the issue of the day was, according to Donald Trump. And I just think it's made us think a little bit differently about how we do U.S. news.
I was really hoping you guys would say Motown and the auto industry, but that's okay.
Motown and the auto industry, I think, have been the highlights of my year. But, I mean, it'd be lying if Stormy Daniels hadn't caught people's attention. And obviously that precipitated a very long, drawn-out discussion in the BBC at the highest editorial circles as to what constitutes a porn star as opposed to just an actress or a supporting actress. This went on for quite a long time. And in the end, different networks chose different ways of describing Ms. Daniels. But to Tim's point, yes, you know, at the start, this was such a remarkable presidency, and we were all completely besieged and enthralled to Mr. Trump's prostate gland, I think, because as soon as he woke up at 5 a.m., to go to the bathroom, there would be a tweet. I've just remembered we're recording this. But this has been one of the adjustments we've had to make about, you know, we've never had this direct communication with the most powerful executive in the world. And yet, sometimes it isn't the most important thing. And, you know, we struggle with that across the world in terms of determining what's happening now, what's the important thing, and what is the urgent event? And, you know, I talk about this to our teams all the time, is that the thing that's happening today, the most important event, isn't the most important thing. So climate change doesn't happen in tweets, doesn't happen in events, it's happening all the time, and as a consequence, loses out a lot of the time to Twitter.
Okay, Joe's stunned me to silence, so it's your turn to ask questions. Here's how we're going to do this. Chrissy will have a microphone, but she's not going to be passing it down. We'd like you to come out into the aisle, and she'll bring the microphone to you, and you can ask your question. And we'd like to know at least your first name and your the town you're from. So over here, we've got a guy who's apparently a Duke fan.
First off, my name's Bill. I'm from Lake Orion. And you guys caused me to think of something that honestly I hadn't thought of before. At the beginning of your presentation, you talked about the uniqueness of the American political system and the government, the checks and balances, and, you know, the executive, the legislative, the judicial. But then you were talking a minute ago about, is there any place else on earth where you'd had a 35-day shutdown of the government? And what caused me to think was, is there any place else on earth that has our kind of government? We have a 35-day shutdown because we have those checks and balances, with the House of Representatives being controlled by the Democrats, the executive being controlled by the Republicans, and an extreme division between the two, which we've rarely seen. In Britain, you don't have that possibility because the executive is always controlled by the majority party. If maybe that's not quite right, but close. And maybe the equivalent would be when you have a vote of no confidence and they turn out the prime minister. So I was just thinking about that. And
so what's your question?
So my point is am I close? I mean, is that right?
Look, the United States is certainly unique. I mean, the point about the shutdown is that that's a product of legislation mandating Congress to shut things down when they can't agree. I was talking about Belgium, where they couldn't form a government, but everything kept running because the civil service kept going. But you might be right. This might be a more effective way of cracking heads together. Certainly. Well, I mean, it certainly forces people ultimately to compromise. And, I mean, in the United Kingdom at the moment, we've currently got a situation where you've got a very divided Houses of Parliament where no one can agree on anything.
I'm from Waterford. And do you think that Trump, and excuse me if I don't call him president, but do you think he represents a peak in celebrification of presidency? Do you think we should have that sort of celebrification of our president?
Well, he's not unique. I mean, in Guatemala, the president there is a man who was a comedian, and it often happens that people who are prominent in public life, I mean, I think the new president of Liberia is George Weah. He's a former footballer. So, you know, these things happen. And I suppose you could say it's almost predictable. If you've got this backlash against the system, you know, famously in the run-up to the Brexit referendum, one of the people very expensively educated people who was on the side of Britain leaving the European Union famously said, when he was being told the latest slew of economic forecasts about the damage that Brexit would cause, he said, well, we've had enough of experts. And that sense that, you know, we've had this class of people from the establishment telling us what is good for us for long enough, and actually, is it really good for us? So in answer to your question, I don't know whether we have reached peak celebrity in politics, but I don't think that it's that much of an aberration necessarily.
Ronald Reagan was an actor. He was a celebrity.
He was a governor before.
He was a governor, obviously, he had been. But being well known is an advantage. I think, you know, everyone on both sides of the Atlantic are looking intently at how lots of people who didn't turn out to vote in previous elections or referendums have come out and expressed a very powerful opinion of dissatisfaction with how things were in the past, that their voices haven't been heard. That and if you look at the United Kingdom, so our parliament is made up much more of professional people. It barely contains people who have done blue-collar jobs. The professionalisation of politics isn't unique to the United Kingdom. You look at Congress here, senators are millionaires. Congress people have got a massive net worth and are required to raise lots of money every week. And that may be a clue as to the dislocation that people feel with the way things have always been. Now, that is what Donald Trump promised in his campaign, that things wouldn't be the same. And that's a very, very powerful message at a time when people have come out of 10 years of a financial crisis.
Lots of hands, Chrissy. Where are you?
I'm right here. Right here. My name is Otuki. I'm from Royal Oak. Quick question about, so most of the time I listen to the president, he compares himself to his predecessors with respect to most of the successes he has achieved. So my question would be that, do you think that he's been held to a different standard as compared to his predecessors with respect to policy making, immigration, the economy, and so forth?
Okay. Look, I think there is something in that. I think you know, Donald Trump talks about immigration, and then 2 days ago, the figures come out that there is a surge in immigration on the southern border. He talks about trade with China. Is that completely crazy? No, there are huge issues with market access for non-Chinese companies in China. There are lots of areas of policy where you might argue that he doesn't get a fair crack at the whip. At the same time, there's lots of other stuff that makes absolutely no sense to lots of people around the world watching. And so it's quite difficult to navigate through that. But because some of the more legitimate things that come out of the White House seem to get crowded out and obfuscated by the other stuff, that also allows the president to say, look, everyone is ganging up on me and they're all fake news.
The other part of his question was, is he being held to a different standard than his predecessors? Do you see that happening?
I don't really. And it's one of the reasons, again, that maybe I'm slightly more optimistic than Joe, who is known around the NewsHour office for being quite miserable. But
I know I like him already.
And I'm the sunny one, very much. Very easy to get along with, as all my colleagues will tell you. But I sort of think, you know, I was the BBC's Middle East correspondent. I worked alongside Joe for several years, and you know, I was based in Jerusalem. I did travel across the region, but when I was in Jerusalem, you know, our big story at the time was Israel and the Palestinians, and unsurprisingly, lots of people felt that the BBC had a certain take on the issue, and that they were being immensely unfair and partisan and partial. And I sort of think that you just keep on plodding on, attempting, being incredibly self-critical about the sort of stories you do, the way you tell those stories. But actually, you know, our job is to try and navigate it, and is to try and explain, and is to try to say this is important. So as far as President Trump is concerned, you know, that is what we're doing, just like we're doing with Brexit, just like we're doing with any other story. And I think as soon as you, I think where President Trump may be right is it is possible, because it is quite seductive, for journalists to sort of get into a slightly oppositional, we're under immense stresses and strains, we're being called by the president fake news and the enemy of the people, and therefore we have to take a more oppositional stance because that's the way in which we survive. And actually, the way in which we survive, I think, and the way in which, again, without wanting to sound sanctimonious, what our audiences want is for them to be able to turn to us and to say, can you just tell me what is going on today in the world? And quite often, it might be a bit plodding and a bit unsexy and in all the sort of cacophony of social media and people hearing what they want to hear and being told it in very crisp ways on Twitter, we might sound like the sort of plodding elderly uncle, but I don't think it's a bad place necessarily to be. And naturally, we're also incredibly sassy and witty and quite sexy, so the plodding elderly uncle is not appropriate.
I want to follow up on just a little bit about what he's talking about. You know, our news director at Michigan Radio, a guy named Vincent Duffy, I've known him for 30 years now. He and I worked in Illinois together, and he has never gotten to the point where if somebody questions what we did in a story, that he said, I'm going to ignore that. He always takes a second look, steps back. We call it navel gazing. I mean, we do a lot of navel gazing, questioning, did we handle that right? Can we do better next time? You guys, I'm sure, do that on a much grander scale, but we all, none of us is so certain about everything that we're going to just reject any criticism. I mean, we have to be self-examining all the time, right?
Yeah, amen to that. And the other thing I would say is that on that is that, again, just one of the great journalistic canards is that if you're getting it in the neck from both sides, somehow you must be getting it right.
No, it's not right.
It's not the case. You may be getting it equally wrong. So just, you know, do what we do, which is try and tell people what's going on. And obviously we're filtering that by deciding what's important, the whole sort of what's the bar on Twitter, and then asking questions about why it's going wrong.
Hi, John from Royal Oak. First thing I wanted to say was I was expecting a different person from BBC to be here, but I understand he couldn't get a visa. I didn't know if he had a comment on it, but I just wanted to know, you guys have done a great job, so you were my step. But I do have a question. since I've got you here about Brexit, I thought it was interesting what you said earlier when you talked to your people on the panel. They had different points of view. My observation of Brexit was that the people who were against it, nobody understood what it was, but the people who were against it seemed to make the best arguments. Even some of them weren't true, but they seemed to make the best points of view that people seemed to agree with, that I think was that a big part of why it won. And now people have learned a lot of the stuff they said was a lie, but they made a better bargain.
Where do we start with Brexit? I'm actually smiling at the moment. It's just Tim can't see it. It's my inner joy just struggles to break out sometimes. So look, the referendum was an extraordinary event in British politics. 17 million people voted to leave and 16 million voted to stay. That was a huge participation in a democratic event in the United Kingdom. Of those 17 million people, they didn't all vote for one particular reason or because of one slogan, but it's obviously something resonated in the campaign. But given that the status quo was supported by all the major parties, by the government, by most of the major politicians, it was an extraordinary turnaround for what obviously the Prime Minister at the time had expected. Did they make a better argument? Well, obviously, something resonated with those people. But I think we go back to some of the issues we spoke about before, about dislocation, about, you know, if you look at turnout in British general elections, and risk of getting too nerdy here, but they'd been dropping since 1992. Lots of people hadn't turned out. and they'd been forgotten. And in 2016, they made themselves heard, and the side that they decided to voice their opinion was the side to leave the European Union. But yeah, stuff was said that wasn't necessarily true. But that's politics.
So we've reached a critical point in the program. This is Issues and Ale. Joe has no ale. I have no ale.
That's why I'm so sad.
Okay, Chrissy. Steve's taking care of that.
Okay, so I'm stepping out here. Hi, Tony from Farmington Hills. Even though I'll preface it by saying I'm originally from Connecticut, which is in New England, more of a progressive part of the world, but I've been in the Midwest for more than half my life. So I get a different perspective. Can I hold that? You're not allowed to? Okay. I'll go to jail. Okay. You touched on populism, and some people in this country talk about tribalism. And the way this country has shifted because of populism to the right, to conservatism, to hard right, conservative right, ultra right, alt right. And that's a very dangerous place for many people in this country. Could you just give your perspective from London and Europe about the dangers that your side of the world, of the Atlantic, has seen looking at the United States versus what's been going on in Europe? In some ways, Trump has sucked the air out of the room about a lot of issues, so you never hear about some of this, but I'd like to get your perspectives on what you see over there on your side, what you see about our country.
I certainly think that what we're seeing, partly through Donald Trump, and I'll sort of come back to that in a moment to explain why I'm qualifying it in a little while if I don't forget my point. But I think that what we're seeing is out of this sort of sense of turbulence in politics, we're actually seeing different ways of looking at politics from the left as well as the right. So, I mean, clearly, in Britain, the main opposition, Labour Party, is now much further to the left than it has been for a very long time. Whether it gets a chance to put those policies into action, we'll have to wait and see, because at the moment, the opinion polls suggest that it's not doing necessarily that well against what should be quite a weak Conservative government. And when you compare Jeremy Corbyn in terms of favourability ratings with Theresa May, given, you know, what a tough time she's been having of it recently, well, he doesn't seem to be doing that well. But certainly the sort of politics from the left of centre that we're seeing now becoming, in a sense, part of the mainstream in Britain is something that just would not have seemed possible at the start of this century. And I think you'll be seeing similar things. Well, you have seen similar things to that in on the mainland of Europe. I mean, you've seen it with the Greek government, which brought in Syriza a few years ago. Again, a radical left government. The reason I think partly down to Trump is that I think one of the questions that we simply can't answer yet is how far the phenomenon of Trump, of populism and of nationalism is being driven by Donald Trump, and how far he is a function of what we're seeing sort of around the world, and, you know, what we're seeing in Brazil, what we've seen in Turkey, what we've seen across Europe, in Hungary, in Poland, and other places. So, you know, it's difficult to say who sort of started it, but, you know, it would be ridiculous to suggest that, as it's where we started, the US, you know, you matter. So what goes on here is of just endless importance and fascination to the rest of the world.
Do you have any observations?
I'm going to be optimistic. I know. It's a physical act. So looking at populism in Europe and here, if you want, but certainly in Europe, one of the things that repeats itself again and again is that people are not turning away from democracy. They're turning away from traditional parties. They're not turning away from the process of expressing themselves. They want more expression. They want a voice heard, and they are finding parties that are new to deliver that message. And so, you know, we're not seeing people turning their back on democracy. They want more democracy. They want more of a say. And you can look at Brexit as being a way of people having more of a say. You can look at the demands for change in populist elections in Europe as people wanting more of a say. What's clear is that the traditional political parties have got their work cut out to capture that sense and to redress a sense that these people are not having their voices heard. But also there is a recognition, and this is, I think this is shared in Europe and America, that immigration has changed people's view of society, of themselves, of their place in their countries. And for a long time, certainly in the UK, political debate about immigration was put to one side. It raised difficult questions. It often led to some very ugly expressions and racism. But because of that, it wasn't debated. And because it wasn't debated, what happened was that society changed. Nobody bothered to ask anyone about it or talk to many people about it. And so when that became an important issue during the referendum campaign, well, people said, yeah, Southampton is now 10% Polish. Did anyone ask the people of Southampton about that? No. But these are difficult things. And you know, established parties have self-censored about it. That space for constructive and adult debate hasn't been found. And so that leaves the door open for some very uncomfortable views and some parties in Europe, like the Alternative for Deutschland, like Vox Party in Spain, which are worrying a lot of people around the world.
Hi, I'm Stacey from Clausen. And I'm wondering if you feel that the media is contributing to the rise, because you're hyper-focused on the tweets. I know that we have a short attention span. I know that people like their sound bites. But it takes 3-4 pages of Google to get through what's actually happening in politics, what our representatives are doing to us through our voting rights, women's rights, the LGBT community. And nobody's talking about it because we are spending hours upon hours focusing on a ridiculous tweet that is completed by a absolute imbeciles, probably sitting on the toilet for crying out loud. So I would like to see the media literally stop giving him the fuel that he needs to survive and start telling us what we need to survive and what's being done to us. Thoughts?
Let me just step in for a second. I know you guys, but there's one thing that, and this gets asked a lot, questions like this get asked a lot, and I could tell you, especially for my commercial brethren, commercial radio, commercial TV, if people are going to tune into you because they're covering the tweet, that's a good thing for them. And so when you guys stop being interested in the tweets, they'll stop bringing it to you. They'll bring you what you want. I mean, I'm sorry, that's the way the commercial side works. So you guys have...
Yeah, look, I mean, we've spoken about this briefly this evening. You know, we took some time to calibrate our response to presidential tweets. We've never had the most powerful individual in the world communicating directly without going through a press conference or a press officer. But, you know, we don't cover all the tweets. We're lucky we're publicly funded. We don't have to. But there is a structural problem in news about the immediacy of the now, the shiny thing, taking primacy over the important stuff. And that, again, is something that we aim to do all the time, but it's hard. But that's why, you know, having reporters, having beat reporters, having correspondency travel who get out into communities is really important, because that allows you to tell actual stories. It's very easy to sit in an office with a Twitter feed open and write copy. But that's not what we do.
And it's also why, and it may be delusional, but it is genuinely why I am optimistic about the sort of journalism that we do. Because I do think that, you know, whilst there is this is incredibly seductive sort of cacophony of tweets and outrage and tweets and outrage, that actually it creates a tremendous amount of space for us to do the sort of thing that we do and we have been doing for a very long time. And it is, you know, it is a source of joy to me as a NewsHour anchor that when we have a program that has got it, you know, forget the sort of heavyweight interviews that I might get to do sitting behind the desk in London, when there are a series of reports from our correspondents around the globe telling me stuff about places that I've barely heard of, but have got remarkable stories, sometimes just astonishing human interest stories, sometimes stories that I simply, you know, didn't know were happening, or stories that resonate, for example, about climate change or about migration or whatever it is, in new ways with different voices. Those are the programs that absolutely sing to me. And I think, you know, dare I say it, and forgive the sort of infomercial side to this, but it's the reason that our audiences appear to be growing as well, is that I do think that there is an appetite for that, and I find that enormously cheering. So, you know, I hear what you say, and my goodness me, we find it seductive as well, but we are also trying to do the "this is what matters and this is why" shtick.
How many correspondents do you guys have around the world?
Lots.
Yeah. this is what you want from your journalist: accuracy,
yeah.
Specifics.
I always say, actually, to young journalists who increasingly don't seek my opinion, that one of the best answers you can give as a reporter is, "I don't know." But, I mean, you know, it is one of the things that we pride ourselves on is that we do have a huge number of correspondents and stringers and staff around the world. And one of the traditions of the BBC World Service, which has been around for decades and is, you know, in part a product of Britain's once outsized role in the world, is that we have vast numbers of language services. So we don't just broadcast in English, we broadcast in dozens of different languages around the world, and that gives us scope to have loads and loads of reporters who are embedded in these countries and are real experts, and they are the most wonderful font of intelligence. And you know, again, it's one of the things that makes it an absolute joy to be a part of this club.
Hello, my name is Rida. I'm from Dearborn Heights by way of Baghdad. Want to have a question regarding social media. Has it created a more toxic environment to have political discussions? Because I find it somewhat useful sometimes to find out about issues and problems happening worldwide. And I do have a follow-up question. What do you think of our fair city, Detroit?
Look, social media has I'm going to be the optimist first. Okay, so social media allows me to hear people's views that I would never have managed to hear in the past. I can travel around the world on my laptop or my phone and directly engage with people who are living in parts of the world that I can't get to. So journalistically, that's amazing. It also allows people to contribute to a debate in society on policy issues, on all sorts of stuff. It also sadly allows anyone to pile into a huge round of abuse on some of my colleagues and on other individuals, and that is toxic. And in the UK at the moment, people are really struggling with that, and I'm sure you are in the States as well. And I think, you know, the smartphone is, what, 10 years old? You know, we still don't know how to use that responsibly. We don't have licenses or tests. We're kind of getting used to it. I think it's changing. You know, I'm addicted to my phone so much so, you know, my kids don't have one. But it's really difficult. but it's a it is a fantastically participative medium, and that side of it is a great thing. And the other part of your question was about Detroit. Tim.
Interestingly, Joe's kids are 32, 27, and 25 years old. One of the great things about my job is I get to travel. One of the sad things about my job is that when I get to travel, unfortunately, it's often on extremely tight schedules. So I've been in a car going to different bits of Michigan, speaking to very interesting people. I've had remarkably little time to explore Detroit. That and the fact that I'm useless in the cold has meant that... I was saying to Liz, who's been working with me as the NewsHour producer over the last couple of days, that, in fact, just the drive today from the Motown Museum to here, I sort of said to her in a voice of wonder, just that 15-minute drive, I said, I finally feel as if I'm seeing Detroit, because I just hadn't. So I feel privileged but immensely frustrated. I'm sure it is one of the great cities of the world, but I just can't say that with conviction.
And apparently there are two places that do chili dogs that are apparently really good.
A lot more than two, but those two are
apparently
side by
those
side.
Two, yeah, and, yeah. And that depending on which one you like, then that will set your entire life apart from everyone else. But these are
we don't call them
things.
Chili dogs here either. Yeah,
what you call
Coney dogs? Coney dogs.
Coney dogs.
Yeah,
I'll get my coat.
It's a long story.
Hi, my name's George. I'm from Ferndale. And I have two-pronged question. So one, just responding to him, I can't stand getting political stuff off social media. It drives me away from people because in a way we kind of sit in this echo chamber where really crazy ways of thinking about things, I think, you start to bubble up and it kind of like polarizes everybody. But we don't share the same information. And two things. So one, I'd like Lester to maybe comment on what if he held this same discussion 40, 50 miles away from here and, you know, north of here, and you probably have a very different crowd of people. And two, you use the word alleged, and he allegedly paid a port. He allegedly. And we are now relying on comedians to actually cut through some of that and just like say things as they really are, because and strip out some of the terminology that the news outlets tend to pick up and echo each other on and kind of amplify messages on. So if you could comment on those.
Well, first of all, I've done a lot of these. Steve, we've been in Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo. We were in Royal Oak. We've been in Detroit. We've been in Lansing and in a lot of places I don't remember. Rockford, Michigan one time. So I have had those different crowds. And I got to tell you, the one thing I find is really common about the public radio folks are they're really curious and they have good questions. It's really not that much different here than 40 miles from here because you guys are all in the same kind of public radio mentality and club. I mean, you're curious people and you're aware and you ask good questions and you know, only on very rare occasions do we have somebody actually take the mic away and start ranting and then we just shut it down and wait till that person is escorted out the building. That's happened twice in the many years we've been doing
it. Come on, Detroit.
All right. What was the second part of the question?
You were asking about why comedians manage to cut through when news broadcasts don't, I think. Well, and that's a really interesting question and for us in the news business to see people like Jon Stewart or
Colbert. Yeah,
Colbert and all the others. And what they're doing is they're calling it as they see it. They're shouting BS at this and this is an outrage at that. And in between, they're delivering quite a lot of journalism. And so, you know, watching it from a very traditional news organisation, that raises some interesting questions for us. But it is also a flip side of this, of wanting to be surrounded by people who think the same as you. And so there's the risk in that, is that, you know, you surround yourself on Facebook with people who think the same, and you applaud each other, or we applaud each other for thinking the same thing, and we don't tend to introduce different people's views onto our timelines or social media feeds. And doing what comedians do is difficult for us. I mean, the BBC has had a go at doing that domestically in the UK. But you reach one crowd, and we're trying to be your universal news service for everyone who pays for us and for people around the world. And as soon as we stand on one side of the debate and say, this guy's bad, we lose something, I think, as the BBC, and it's difficult. But we also, and I completely understand why it's much more entertaining and ultimately a better way of communicating a lot of journalistic information to do it like Jon Stewart did it.
There have been a bunch of you who have said something about, you know, the stuff you see on social media, but I have a question for you. How many of you here intentionally keep someone in your Facebook feed who disagrees with everything you believe in?
And not your mom.
Ah, I love you guys. Yeah, not your mom. That's great. I really appreciate it. I mean, I do simply because I, as a reporter, I feel like I have to understand all those views to understand, so I don't get in that echo chamber. I mean, you know, I don't want to be in some kind of world where I don't understand what everybody else is thinking. So,
I'm Rob. I'm from Royal Oak. You guys get around, and I want to run an idea by you. It's my opinion that the climate change is the most critical crisis facing the entire world. Now, that's a political divider here. And I guess what I'm asking you, because you guys get around, is that, are we behind the curve on that? I get the impression that the rest of the world is further ahead, and for some reason or another, America dawdles behind. Is that accurate?
Well, clearly, there has been one country which has withdrawn from the Paris Climate Change Accord. And that is the United States. That having been said, you know, there's an awful lot of humbug. There's an awful lot of sanctimony and hypocrisy about this because there are an awful lot of countries in the world that signed on to the Paris Climate Change Accord in 2015. And you look at where they are in 2019 and you ask, well, actually, how much change have they affected? How much special pleading are they doing at the moment? But in terms of, I mean, you were saying, you know, I think part of your question was suggesting that there is still some debate in this country about climate change. I mean, and it slightly pertains to what the previous question was about. You know, there are some stories where we can call it on the BBC. I mean, you know, we try to be impartial and even-handed, which does not mean simply saying on the one hand, on the other hand. But there are certain stories which we cover, climate change, Alex Jones and Sandy Hook, vaccinations, where, you know, is the earth flat all round? Where we can say with a certain degree of conviction, actually, we know what the story is, so let's just get on with it. If we're doing something about an uptick in measles cases around Europe, you know, we can say what one of the causes is, or one of the correlations at the very least, in terms of the anti-vaxxer movement, and we don't have to debate whether there's any truth behind what the anti-vaxxers are saying. So in that sense, you know, I think we can say that the debate has moved on. If there is more debate here as to whether climate change is real or not, yeah, that might be an outlier. But in terms of actually how far moves are being made to combat climate change, I mean, yes, you can say that the United States is lagging, but I certainly don't think it's unique.
And also, I think at a sort of central government level, yeah, there has been a change of policy in the last 2 years. On NewsHour, we cover climate change every week. We made a commitment to do that over and above all the other stuff that we would ordinarily do just because it's so important and because it doesn't get enough attention. But again and again, we come back to the US for innovation at a state level, at a city level, about how people are trying to decarbonize the economy. And so from one perspective, places like California, Washington State, are miles ahead of the rest of the world in the climate change debate.
Good evening. My name is Constance, and I live in the city of Detroit. Welcome.
Thank you.
So I'm really enjoying the conversation and the humor. I didn't know Brits were so comedic. I do have a question. You'll have to tolerate a little bit of editorialization because I've waited so long. So two concerns I have in the dialogue tonight. One seems to be a minimization of the threat to the media in our country. And the second, and with apologies, is it seems a bit of pandering to this so-called disgruntled, disenfranchised populace that is not just in our country but global. So about the threat to the media, we're, I think, the only country that protects the media in our Constitution. And I, as a citizen, I applaud that. I'm not a journalist. I'm an architect. But I want our media to be free and independent and protected. And, you know, Lester, you said, okay, maybe they're not being jailed or murdered, but how much longer before, you know, I really think that we have to take this more seriously. You know, if the leader of our country is saying that the media are a threat, you know, or an enemy. Second, about this, the disenfranchised, right, populace. So I watched the next Netflix docudrama about Brexit. Has everybody seen that? And you should watch it. It's really fascinating because, you know, it seems like the same thing that happened in our country, and it didn't start with the last election. Really, it goes back to the Koch brothers, when President Obama was first elected. You know, there's this sort of targeting with technology of a certain populace, right? Poorly educated, racist, violent, disenfranchised. And, you know, that's what was fascinating to me. That's why Brexit occurred, right? That's why the 17 million versus 16 million, because they targeted this one population. And the same thing happened in our last election. So, you know, my concern is, as we go forward, is that how our political future is determined? By this small percentage of populace. So my question to you is, as the media, both, and I'd like Lester to respond as well as BBC, what are you doing about it? How are you reaching those people so that they don't just have a single source of news, which is likely very, very swayed by billionaires, by these huge, affluent elitist interests, and that they're making decisions that are not even in their own best interest. So how are you going to reach them? Thank you.
So look, what you've made is an excellent argument for publicly funded journalism, because, you know, we don't rely on billionaires with political views. They don't have. I don't have a heavy editorial hand on my shoulder telling me what to do and what to put in my program. How do we reach these people? Well, actually, in the UK, I mean, I've just got to pick you up on the Brexit stuff. There's 17.5 million people. They're not all racists and bigots. Okay, 76 million Americans who voted for Donald Trump aren't either. That's really my point. Is that this is a multitude of reasons why people voted in ways that most of us didn't expect, and that we really need to understand why that is. And while the sort of social media manipulation is important and one that has got a lot of attention and is getting legislative attention in lots of parts of Europe at the moment, It's not the only reason. It's very seductive to think, ha ha, Facebook, what did it? That's why my view of the world was so challenged by this election, because someone with a lot of money and some computers and some very clever people were evil and manipulated a handful of people. And I think it's much more complicated than that, and it's much broader than that, although that is an important part. So in the UK, we've got very strict election rules about funding, about advertisements, and we haven't caught up. The legislation hasn't caught up with social media. And that's something that people are really worried about. And you saw the French president talking about it this week, about social media and elections and trying to protect the integrity of elections. How do we reach these people? Well, for a start, we've got to have more of them working for us. Right? We can't draw our organisations from a very narrow base. We can't all be from Tim's College in Oxford. They should come from my college in Cambridge. And I think that's an important point. And look, I didn't mean to minimise, it was a slightly flippant point about the threat to journalism. It's an extraordinarily shocking thing to have an American president trying to demonise the media. And it does echo around the world. So you will hear the Philippine president use the same language. You will hear people, despots and authoritarians around the world, talk about fake news. And I just think, going back to Tim's point, setting ourselves up in opposition to anyone is not a good thing for journalists. We keep doing what we're doing, keep saying what we're saying. I just think once organisations like the BBC become lobbyists, then we've lost.
Just a very brief coda to that, and again, I may be accused of being a Pollyanna-ish about this, but you know, one way to look at all the obsession, as far as President Trump is concerned, with fake news and the enemy of the people and so forth, is it shows that we, the media, continue to matter. That, you know, what is being said by us, how we are reporting things, has an effect. If, you know, the worst thing would be if we're being ignored and we stopped mattering and audience sizes started diminishing. And I just think, you know, the rhetoric is unpleasant, but at the moment, by and large, it is rhetoric, fortunately, in the United States. And, you know, you know this as well as me, that around the world there are journalists labouring under far worse conditions than they are here, thank goodness.
So, to ask the part of the question you want from me, I'll start by saying those people are listening to our station. They don't let you know that, but they are. You would be surprised what an overlap we have with Rush Limbaugh. I was surprised. Now, let me tell you a little story. I just did a speech on this 2 weeks ago. I'll try to make this as brief as possible. So, when commercial radio, when you were younger, commercial radio stations all had a newscaster, right? Or, you know, a whole news team. Almost all of them are gone now. The country stations don't have them anymore. The rock and roll stations don't have newscasts anymore. You don't see that anymore. Yes, you've got a couple of good commercial radio news stations in town here, but across the board, they've disappeared. Newspapers have been declining because of many reasons, the pressures of the internet and trying to keep up with that, the fact that big corporations are buying this and trying to glean them down to the bare minimum and still make money off of them. So that's diminished. TV has spent a lot of time adopting this if it bleeds, it leads type of news, plus puppy dog stories at the end. Those are important. That's all gone to benefit public radio. We've had, when I started at Michigan Radio 20 years ago, I can't tell you the numbers, we're not allowed to talk about the numbers, but I can tell you this. When I started at Michigan Radio 20 years ago, we had 1/5 of the audience we do today. We've grown because people are looking for a place where they can get legitimate news. And so that has helped a lot, but not just liberal people or independent people or libertarian people, but conservative people are also realizing, wow, Well, I don't like some of the things they cover. I wish they wouldn't talk about LGBTQ issues as much, but where else am I going to get this kind of coverage? I can't find it anywhere. I have two commentators, political commentators on stateside on Friday, a former Democratic legislator and a former Republican legislator. The Republican legislator was the majority leader in the Senate. I have covered him. I was reminded that they weren't always flattering stories about him. His name's Ken Sikkema. He would be considered a moderate Republican today, although at the time when he was in office, he was considered to be quite conservative. We've had him on our station for several years now. I was at a gathering for Bridge Magazine. Ken was there because he's connected to Bridge as well. And he was telling me, you know, when I went on public radio, I didn't even know what it was. But then I found out all of my friends, Republicans, were saying, I heard you. He said, that's never stopped. He said, you would not believe how many of my party members listen to this station. I'm going, yeah, I would, actually, because I've seen the numbers. So we are reaching that audience. They just disagree with a lot of the things that we cover and the facts that we follow. You're talking about experts. We've had enough of experts. We've had enough of facts. Well, these guys still believe that people who are experts might have something to contribute to the story. You know, we believe that facts are important to making sure that we understand the story. That's where we're at right now. We're still listening to experts and looking at facts. And there are a lot of Republicans who like that, a lot of conservatives who like that, a lot of liberals and Democrats who like that, a lot of people in the middle who like that, a lot of independents, a lot of libertarians. We've got a big audience, and it just keeps getting bigger because we're offering them the truth as we can find it. We got time for one more question. Nope, she's already got somebody.
My name's Nancy. I'm from Chesterfield. And my question is, in the depths of some of the despair about what's going on, it's been intimated that this is the beginning of fascism. Now, that's from our point of view in the U.S. I'm interested from a British point of view, where your history is obviously much more tied into that. Do you see that?
I think it's really difficult to plot where we are on this continuum, if it is a continuum. I mean, where we started at the beginning of this evening was sort of talking about the amount of turbulence, the fracturing of the picture, the shaking of the kaleidoscope, whatever image you want to use, but the fact that, you know, the accepted order and the way of doing things seems to have been severely shaken. Now, you know, it's one of those comforting metaphors that people come up with about politics, about the sort of the pendulum swinging. So, you know, if it's swung this way one election, the chances are it'll swing the other way. It may well be that the pendulum's broken, you know, and that what we see at the end, you know, forget about what's happening here, but around the world in terms of populism and nationalism and that sense of a maybe increasing us versus them, it's a zero-sum game, that, you know, that shakes out in ways that are considerably more dramatic than they are right now. But I think it's really difficult for us to make any predictions. I also think that sometimes in the journalism business, labels are, you know, they're dangerous things to deal in. I think that we just need to talk about what is going on and why it matters, and not sort of try and say this goes to show that X deserves this ism. So you can absolutely fairly criticize me for sort of hedging, but I do sort of think that we need to just sit back and observe. Doesn't stop us asking some very, very hard questions about why are you doing this and what do you expect to get out of it. But You know, we have to be careful about using labels like that because it also suggests that something is completely morally beyond the pale.
You get the last word, Joe.
Yeah, look, I'd agree with that, that you know, history provides lots of useful examples of how people have organised themselves, how things went terribly wrong. There is no inevitability in anything. But the point about labels is really important. That what you see, and we go back to the social media point, is that once you call someone a fascist, you don't have to debate them. You don't have to counter their arguments. You don't have to ask critical questions. You just put them in the corner and point at them. And that is not a healthy way to be a journalist. And so it's not a healthy way of explaining the world, as far as I can see. And so the label thing is incredibly important. Why label? It closes down debate. Asking questions, asking difficult questions, opens up debate.
Can I have a hand for the BBC NewsHour? Tim Franks, Joe Floto, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.